Shoes. Recorded live.
Hi, welcome to Masonic Central. Today is November 2nd of 2008. This is our 16th episode of the podcast. This is Greg Stewart and Dean Kennedy. I'm on the West Coast, Dean's in Canada, and we're here with our weekly podcast show, By Freemasons, For Freemasons. This show is hosted to explore the depths of the Masonic world, and if you're new to the program, please visit our website at MasonicCentral.com or send us an email at MasonicCentral@gmail.com. And for everybody out there who has sent us an email, your decals are on the way. And for anybody who's listening now and you have something you'd like to send us, a question or a comment, and we read it on the air, then we'll put your name in there and send you off a decal also to say thanks for sending us the note and for reading it on the air. So send us all of your emails. Check out our upcoming shows at the website at MasonicCentral.com. We'll talk a little bit at the end of the program about who's coming up and what's going on. And this is a live program that we record weekly where the listeners can interact and contribute to the conversation. If you'd like to follow our conversation live, again at MasonicCentral.com, and you can listen on the internet, chat, ask questions, and be a part of the great dialogue. And just as a little bit of a disclaimer, all the content herein is representative of ourselves, the host, Dean and I, and our contributors and our guests, and does not represent any particular opinion of any regular or irregular grand or otherwise Masonic body. Further, Masonic Central does not have an agenda, nor is it a recruitment tool for any particular body of Freemasonry. This week, how you doing, Dean? I guess let me say how you doing first. How's it going, man?
I'm doing just fine. I'm still breathing.
Still breathing? Things going well with the baby? Are you getting a much shut-eye?
Not really, but that's fine. I'm making do.
It's a good thing. That's a good thing. That's that fatherly love there. You got to earn your dues there, man. This week, everybody, we have a very special guest coming to us out of Guthrie, Oklahoma, and his name is Robert Davis. How you doing tonight, Robert?
I'm doing fine, Greg. Doing fine. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. I'm very glad you were able to join us. And so everybody knows, Bob Davis is, let me go to his information here. Bob, you're on the par with our guest that we had last week. As you may remember, in talking, we had Tom Jackson here. Bob Davis is the executive secretary of the Guthrie Scottish Rite Bodies in Oklahoma, a past master of three Masonic lodges, and a recipient of the Grand Cross, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's correct.
Quite a busy man here, just in reading this brief history of yourself, and an author of a book, one already out and one coming up, that we'll talk a little bit about here today, too. So how are you doing tonight? How are things in Oklahoma? Did the time change get you?
Time change got me, just made me a little tired, but things are beautiful here. The weather is 80 degrees today, which is unusual for this late in the year, and we're taking full advantage of it. Been outside all day.
It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. We actually had rain here on the West Coast, which was surprising. It never rains in Los Angeles, but go figure. So, Bob, thanks for coming on tonight. I know in looking at some of this and in some of the pre-planning for the show, I definitely want to talk a little bit about the Scottish Rite. I'm curious, though, and as we've sort of asked every guest who's come on, tell us a little bit about who you are. Who is Bob Davis, and how did you come into Masonry? How did you find yourself in a lodge?
Well, Greg, I guess I should first of all let everyone know that I'm a baby boomer, and that makes me a little bit of an anomaly because, as most sociologists would know, baby boomers were the non-joining organization, and few of us followed our fathers into the fraternity, and I was an exception to that. My father was an active Freemason, and his brother was an active Freemason. I was raised in a farm and ranch background in northwestern Oklahoma, and our father's lands, my father and his brother's land, joined each other. And every Wednesday night, they would come in from their chores, take a bath, put on their Sunday suit, slap on Old Spice deodorant, and my uncle would come by and pick my father up, and they would go to lodge, and they did that for 50 years. And so I never knew a time when I was not going to be a Freemason. I rummaged through the regalia closets when I was young. I went to potluck dinners of the lodge and was pretty much just kind of raised around the lodge environment, and it never felt like anywhere but home to me. And so I know that was unusual for my generation, because many, many men entering the fraternity today, when they speak of family ties, you know, they're talking about their grandfathers or their great-grandfathers were Masons. So I was one of the lucky few that was connected to this sense of father-son, brotherly sharing, and being a part of the community of Freemasons, even as a young man.
That's interesting. As you were growing up, this is probably a strange question, but did you ever talk to your family about joining? Was it ever something that was ever even a consideration in the sense of you would or you wouldn't, or is it just sort of a unspoken aspect of something that you would do as you got older?
I don't think anybody had to talk to me about it. I, being raised on in a farm and ranch environment, the closest community to our place was a town of about 2,500 population, and it's where we would go to celebrate the celebrations of our lives. And whenever we would go to town, would always meet a number of men of the community. And back in those days, the stores stayed open late, and people parked along the streets and visited during the evening. And so, through my boyhood, I got acquainted with the merchant owners and the bankers and the lawyers and the abstractors and the judges and everybody that had a place of business along the main street in my small town. And in addition to that, my father, besides being a farmer, worked for the Department of Agriculture and the Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service. And so after school, I would go to his office and hang out with the men in his office. And I always had these associations with the men of the community. And I've told this to men in several speeches where I've made introductions of myself. When I petitioned the lodge, I'll never forget standing in the preparation room waiting for a response to my knocks on the door of the lodge, and thinking to myself at that moment that tonight I was going to be initiated into manhood, because so many of the men that were friends of my father's and important men in the community were present at lodge when I came to lodge. And being a young man, I would see them at potluck dinners in lodge, and so it was just it was a remarkable experience for me, and it inspired me to want to be like they were, even as a young man. And I thought that's if I didn't get anything out of Freemasonry, the connectedness that I would have with older generation of males whom I dearly respected would have to improve my life. And that's just the way it was with me. At least that's the way I saw it.
It's interesting, and perhaps I should have mentioned it earlier on, but for those who would like to and listening to this and some point down the line, you're now writing in a blog. There's a Robert, let's see here, robertgdavis.blogspot.com, which we linked to in the initial description of the show coming up. But in that blog, you've written about this idea of the small town Freemasonry, which I would say is probably what you just described.
Yes, and I've always felt that small-town Freemasonry was the most successful model for Freemasonry. Certainly, it has been in the 20th century, and it still works today if the men in the lodge have the right vision for what the lodge can not only do for men as a fraternal thing, but also for their communities. And I think in one of the blogs I talk about two lodge models that I think can still be highly successful in America today. And then there's a third idea we might talk about during the course of the interview. But small town Masonry has the best opportunity to be successful, because it's much easier to become connected to so many of the families in the community. There's hardly anyone that you don't come to know over the course of your life. So I think it's the model that has always been successful.
I think definitely a takeaway from that is just that aspect of what you said, is that connection to the community, just rather than being a participant or a idle sitting by, actually participating in it and doing and being a mover and a shaker, not necessarily in a grandiose way, but certainly as an interested citizen. And I think some of that idea is evaporated in some sense from the lodge. Not that the lodge should promote that, but just that interest into it. Would you say, have you seen that today in comparison to what was back then?
Well, I think it has changed in this regard. Because of the persistent and alarming rate of out-migration from rural America into the urban centers, fathers' sons no longer live in the same communities as their fathers. And certainly since the Depression, we have not seen the three males in the single household, in some case four males in the single household that we always had in all of the generations of men prior to the Depression. So while my town was economically viable and active when I was a young man with a population of 2,500, I also know painfully well that town now has a population of 1,000, and there's very few young men left in the area, and so there's very few men for the lodges in those really small towns, especially in rural areas, to draw on for their membership. So what I have seen happen is that as towns have gotten smaller in rural America, lodges have declined steadily. Many of them have given up their charters, consolidated with other lodges, and that's a real sad thing. But on the positive side of it, towns that are 5,000 population above still can represent the same kind of fraternal vitality in their communities that the towns of 2,000 used to be able to do 40 years ago. And so I still think it's accurate to suggest that small-town Freemasonry still has a wonderful opportunity to be successful today. I've always felt it was the most difficult to have a viable Masonic community in large metropolitan areas, and just because it is so difficult for people to establish many, many, many different intimate relationships in large metropolitan areas. And then there's another paradigm that we have in most grand jurisdictions, and that is that if there's been 25 lodges in your metropolitan area for 50 years or 100 years, the paradigm has been those are the 25 locations where men can become Masons, and because we've always been driven by large numbers in lodges rather than just the intimate relationship of men who know each other, they don't have a chance to, I think, interrelate with the larger community as small towns would. We'd be much better served if we would adapt the European model where lodges are 50 to 100 members, everybody knows everybody, they know everybody's families, they serve as godfathers to their brother's children, and you have 1,000 lodges in a metropolitan area rather than 25. I think it worked much better in metropolitan areas with that kind of a system.
That's interesting that you say that. That seems to be a common theme and a thread that we've been hitting upon here. I know Dean, as a resident expert of Nova Scotia and me in this large jurisdiction of California, we operate under two completely different systems. Whereas Dean, they talk about wanting to push their membership level past 50, and my lodge
only in my lodge.
Well, but my lodge having to prune back from 500. So there's definitely that dynamic going on of difference taking place. And personally, I think I tend to agree with that. That's interesting in your observation, which takes me to another question of where you're at now, and especially within the Guthrie Scottish Rite. Do you see that sense of community, or is it operating under that premise of large lodges, large memberships?
Well, I think the Grand Lodge of Oklahoma is typical of all other American Grand Lodges. We have these lodges with large memberships, and the lodges that are quite small have been the lodges in the smaller communities that are small because they've lost their population base. But I belong to two lodges currently in Oklahoma. One is a local lodge in my Guthrie community, and then I organized and served as a charter master of a traditional observance lodge because I wanted to bring that kind of lodge experience into the dynamic, especially knowing what the needs of younger men are. But in my community lodge, it's as viable as it's ever been. Now, we may have one thing that's a bit unique to us, and that is that the seat of Freemasonry in Oklahoma happens to be in Guthrie. The Grand Lodge of Oklahoma was organized in Guthrie. The Masonic Charity Foundation was organized in Guthrie. The Masonic homes were built in Guthrie. So in my town, which is a town of a population of 10,000, we have more Masons per capita than any town in Oklahoma. And until we closed the Masonic home a few years ago, we had over $1 million payroll in our community. So the community leaders always saw the fraternity as being an economic element to the community, as well as an element that did a lot of community good. So the reason that we've got that heritage there, which might be somewhat unique, but the reason that my local lodge in my Guthrie community is successful is just because the members are committed to be out in the community with a public face, being involved with a lot of charitable programs and giving scholarships, and so they are as visible as any other civic club, for instance, in the town, and their charitable base is larger than other civic clubs. So that makes a public statement. I'm not one who believes that Freemasonry should be a charitable organization. I'm just simply saying that when you have a strong public image and it's a positive image in your town, then your propensity to always take in new members is going to be much higher than if you've boarded up your windows and decided to stay totally within your tiled recesses.
All right. Go ahead.
Greg, I just wanted to add one thing. Would it be therefore be easy to say that that activity breeds activity? It's something that we talk about in various occupations, where you by creating activity it breeds more activity. So if you have an active lodge, you're bound to get more active. Or more successful?
Yes, and it does something more important than that. It breeds connectivity. Men like to be associated with organizations that are not only that they perceive are making a worthwhile contribution to their community. They like to belong to organizations that have other men in them who they perceive have status in the community. And so a lodge can very much be a status conduit for men. Now, I realize that it doesn't work that way in many lodges, but for the lodges that have a long history of community involvement and activity, they almost always also have a long history of community leaders in the lodge.
Something interesting there, and what Dean had asked and the response to it, it struck me how similar that was to what you described as your growing up experience in the small town.
Yeah.
Just in having that connectivity with the different shop owners and the different people within the community, and even the board that we have running where the folks are talking, it's that activity of community, of knowing who your neighbors are and participating with them and seeing you even as part of this group, you know, whether or not it's Freemasonry or a church group, there'll be an association of your activity with that group, even if you're not doing it out there waving a flag saying, hey, I'm doing this for, you know, this such and such lodge.
I think that's very true, and I think that's a vision that could be successful for lodges and in the American culture. I know that there's men out there listening who are thinking to themselves, my lodge doesn't have anybody like that in it. You know, my lodge couldn't organize a good picnic, let alone save the world, But my response to that is that if that's the kind of lodge you have, that's the kind of lodge that you have made over a period of generations. I know that's not the kind of lodge that they started with when those lodges were chartered in the beginnings of their states. And so... You know, we need to measure our success around the success that our founding fathers had. And there's, even though our culture has changed a lot, the dynamics that make a fraternal environment work are the same as they always have been.
It's interesting, and you're saying that, and I know that you and I have corresponded on separate subjects about it, but having that same sort of flavor to it, in the sense of making that change in your lodge, and even as just as a slight tangent here to it, your words to me in that regard was really to make a list of the things that you want to see change happen with, and start working that list slowly. And
yes.
And with each progressive step, the sooner rather than later, you'll start seeing those changes in effect. And I think even just as the example was, you know, if you wanted to see candles in your ceremony, you know, it may take a year or two to convince them. But I'm curious what your experience has been with that. Have you encountered lodges that you've been a part of where you've wanted to see that sort of change take place?
Oh, yes. And I think the change can happen faster than we perceive. And I can give you another example. I moved to Guthrie in 1986, having spent the first 14 years of my adult career in city planning and city management in a larger community in Oklahoma. And I was delighted when I moved to Guthrie because I perceived that since the Grand Lodge of Oklahoma, since the Masonic headquarters was in Guthrie, that I would be coming into the most active, viable Masonic Lodge in Oklahoma. And surprisingly, I came into a lodge that was absolutely dead. The community leadership had left their active involvement with the lodge in the 70s, and another group of men had come into the lodge, and it had gotten down to the point where there were only about seven or eight guys that were showing up at each meeting, and I was just flabbergasted. Well, I started attending lodge when I first came to town, and of course they started me through the chairs immediately because they already knew because of my Scottish Rite position that I was an active Freemason. And so when I became senior warden of the lodge, I took the membership list of our lodge and I compared it against the occupation files of our community, and I discovered that all of the community leaders were still members of the lodge. They just simply weren't attending and hadn't been for quite some time. Many of them had been past masters of the lodge in the 60s and 70s. So when I became senior warden, I just went around and started talking with a number of the community leaders and gave them the vision of what kind of lodge Guthrie was, how important it was to Oklahoma's Masonic heritage, how significant it was as a driver of what happened in the community. And we should be the best lodge in the state and not the worst lodge in the state. And I asked them if they would attend lodge. And I told them I was going to have a couple of friends nights. I wanted them to invite friends on that evening, and I wanted them all to be there. And I didn't want them to work in the chairs, conferring the degrees. My Lord, if one thing we have, we certainly have plenty of ritualists. I just needed the status that they had in the community to be in front of men that we were wanting to bring into the fraternity. And they agreed with that vision, and we raised 11 Master Masons the year I was Worshipful Master. And so the vision changed literally in 1 year, and then we just sustained that kind of community awareness from then on, and so the lodge literally reinvented itself. And I would suggest that there's still a lot of lodges out there that are suffering today that if you really look at their membership roles, they still have plenty of community men in the organization. They have just not been personally asked to participate in a number of years. And so it's all about vision and leadership.
I was just going to bring up that you just talked about your lodge and you sat down and made a plan. You planned on how you were going to retain the members or bring the members in and keep them there before you actually went out and sought out the 11 new candidates, correct?
Yes, uh-huh.
I think that oftentimes, and let me ask your opinion on this, but oftentimes the lodges go out and try to get new applications to breed life into their lodge without thinking what's going to happen when they bring them in there, and they end up just basically
without being able to sustain it.
Selling a product that they can't sustain, that's correct.
Well, yes, and the reason they can't sustain it is they're not offering an experience that any longer meets the needs of men. I mean, if there's anything that we can all agree with in Freemasonry, and I know how hard it is for us to agree with anything, but if there's anything I think we agree with across the board, is that the reason only 5% of our members participate is because the special interest that participates are the men who enjoy performing the ritual. I mean, the ritual of the fraternity meets their needs, and so they show up. And if that is the only thing that you give your lodge members, you can never realistically expect your participation rate to increase very much beyond that. And so I think to be successful, you have to offer a broader menu of things for men. And so I think that's how you sustain it. You sustain it by broadening your outlook rather than the focusing in even more. Now there's an obvious exception to that, and that has to do with traditional observance masonry, and we can talk about that later on, but I'm just talking about the average local lodge that's trying to reinvent itself in its own community. It needs to offer a venue or a menu of activities that we know men will participate in. And that's why community projects and charitable causes and partnerships with other organizations in the community and all those kinds of things are just as important as the tiled meetings themselves.
It definitely takes a bit of vision there with it and leadership as something that Tom emphasized very heavily. Just to a point, though, in what you're saying and as a sort of a punctuation to it, and I'd definitely like to move on to a different topic, but each of us play that role. Each of us can take that lead in doing this. It's not an issue of waiting for someone else to do it or to drop the hint to somebody else to do. And I'm curious your thought to that. Do you think that as members of the lodge that each of us have a role in doing this?
I think each of us have a role in seeing to it that our needs as fraternal men are met. And in order to see to that, we have to let the lodge know what our needs are. And we have to organize brothers around our needs so that there's more than one special interest group addressing what the venue of the lodge is going to be. And another thing that is so important to success at the local level is, as unbrotherly as it may sound, not everyone can be a leader. And so not everyone is really eligible to be a Worshipful Master of a lodge. So if you're really serious about reinventing yourself, you try to establish relationships with men who are already leaders in the community and encourage them to bring their leadership skills into the lodge. And when that happens, everything changes. The biggest problem that we have at the local lodge level is not that we don't want to be successful. It's just that the 5% of the guys who are attending lodge don't know how to make it successful.
Very interesting. I actually agree. I agree with that. I'm curious, and to move on to a different subject, we could probably spend the rest of the hour on this one. But I am very curious, and had a few side emails asking me to ask you about it. I'd like to hear a little bit about the Oklahoma Scottish Rite, and in particular, the College of the Consistory and
sure.
the study program. But tell us a little bit about Oklahoma Scottish Rite. How far back does it go? And
I'm always enthusiastic about talking about the Scottish Rite, but in general, because I believe with all my heart that it is the University of Freemasonry, and it was created and exists for one purpose, and that's to bring more light in Masonry to the brethren. The Oklahoma Scottish Rite has a wonderful heritage. We got organized in Oklahoma Territory before Oklahoma was a state. Our Lodge of Perfection was chartered in Guthrie in 1896. And the fellow who created the Scottish Rite in Oklahoma was a remarkable man himself and a great visionary. We call him a first day man because the area known as the unassigned lands between Oklahoma Territory and Indian Territory was opened up for settlement by a land run in 1889. And there was an attorney that was a first day man. His name is Harper Cunningham. And he was on the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite in Washington, D.C., and he came to Guthrie to set up a law practice in Guthrie. And, of course, being on the Supreme Council, he established the Scottish Rite bodies in Oklahoma. But more than that, he became known as the temple builder of Freemasonry. He had a voluminous civic career. He was in the territorial legislature. He was an attorney general. He was in the state senate. He was an attorney for the railroads, and he was a great fundraiser. And he organized a fundraising effort to build a magnificent Masonic building in downtown Guthrie, and that building was finished in 1899. Before Oklahoma was even a state. Then he created a Scottish Rite bodies in southeastern Oklahoma in McAllister, 1905, did the same thing again, created a magnificent building down there, and then he got transferred to New Mexico Territory and raised the building to raise the money for the Santa Fe Temple in downtown Santa Fe, and was instrumental in the vision that ultimately created the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C. That's why I always called him the Temple Builder of Freemasonry. But he had such a grand vision of what was possible that you couldn't help but get caught up in just the magnificence of Freemasonry just through the structures that he envisioned. And so that's kind of how we got started. And then we also happened to get created just at the time when the Scottish Rite decided to adopt the community theater tradition of conveying its lessons. Up until the 1880s, you know, all Scottish Rite degrees were simply communicated, or at best they were conferred in lodge room settings. And the theater movement in America became one of the most popular entertainment venues for American males, and the leadership of the Scottish Rite saw this as a way to adapt the teachings of the fraternity using a vehicle that was a part of the popular culture. And that's how the theater tradition in Freemasonry came to be. And I believe Guthrie was the fourth or fifth valley in the southern jurisdiction to convert to a theater tradition in staging the degrees. And so we ended up outgrowing the original building in 1918, went up the street, acquired a 10.5-acre piece of property that was the original, was originally planted as the capital park for Guthrie, because it was the territorial capital of Guthrie, and acquired the Oklahoma Legislative Hall, the first building to house the Oklahoma Legislature, and then built this magnificent Scottish Rite Temple up on that 10.5 acres, and as magnificent, if not more, than the first building. Well, obviously, much more magnificent even than the first building. And so when you have the largest building in town, and the Oklahoma Historical Society tells everyone it's the most beautiful building in Oklahoma, you've got something you can market in a positive way. And then we also, from the very beginning, had a tradition that we would stage all 29 degrees of the Rite. So we've been around now for more than 100 years, and we still stage all 29 degrees of the Rite. So we've kind of grown in popularity, I guess, on a larger scale, because we have a lot of out-of-state visitors coming and watch the degrees, because many valleys don't confer them all, and it gives them a chance to see the rest of them. So that's the heritage that I came into, and it's the heritage that I continue to try to improve on my watch, so to speak. Hello?
Sorry, Greg's having some technical problems. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing that maybe while I'm picking this up here is that I know a couple of the fellows out in the lobby there are watching. Were asking about kind of taking where we were before and where Greg had led this conversation is. You bring up the idea of the Scottish Rite. You're talking about the Scottish Rite and about reinvigorating the Blue Lodge. Some people would say that, you know, the people are going through the Blue Lodge to go to the Scottish Rite, and I know it's a controversial thing for me to say, but I think it would be wise of me to ask you on your thoughts on that, because obviously, you know, you hear that a lot. So
sure.
What's your thought on that?
Well, I only have one vision, that is that the journey of Freemasonry is the journey to manhood, and it's a journey that a young man makes to move himself from sort of the impetuosity of youth into you know, responsible manly judgment. I like to call that mature masculinity. And so I see all of the degrees in Freemasonry, beginning with the Entered Apprentice degree, as being a different archetype or metaphor for that journey of a man's life. And so I really believe that we have a system of 33 degrees, and men who want to be serious students of Freemasonry will be vastly benefited if they, you know, by experiencing all that Freemasonry has to offer. I feel the same way about the York Rite. I believe every Master Mason should be both a York Rite Mason and a Scottish Rite Mason, because these three organizations together are the essence of the teaching role of Freemasonry. They don't operate independently of each other. The story is not completed with the Master Mason's degree. And so there's a lot of reasons why a man should continue his quest. Now, I do not believe he should continue that at the expense of his local lodge. And I think where the controversy comes in is there's always a certain percentage of overly zealous men that will invite everybody that comes through the Blue Lodge into the Scottish Rite. And many of them, of course, will invite them right on into the shrine. So their vision of Freemasonry is to just acquire the titles for the degrees, be a 32nd degree Mason, you know, be a shrine Mason. But I believe that that is no longer going to work for us, especially right. with this new generation of men. And so we really need to stay focused on our education mission, and that's to improve the individual so that he can improve society through his self-work. And so there's just not anything controversial about the higher degrees if we stay focused on that being the mission.
I actually fully agree with you, you know, as long as people, you know, continue to support their Blue Lodge. And I mean, I look at yourself and we had Tom Jackson on last week, you know, and he's involved in a lot of the bodies, and it just makes them more complete Masons. But I sometimes get that question, and therefore I just wanted to ask someone who's involved in the Scottish Rite, you know, how they handle that question. But
it's just not wise for an active Scottish Rite Mason not to be involved in this Blue Lodge. The success of the Scottish Rite is totally dependent upon the success of the Blue Lodge. And so it doesn't make any difference if that happens to be the thing he loves the most. The fact is that the Scottish Rite won't continue to survive if the Blue Lodge doesn't survive. And so we have to always be active there.
Thank you.
Sorry about that, gentlemen. I lost my connection there for a moment, so I'm back. Did I miss anything?
I handled things for you, Greg, while you're away. We have
excellent.
Bob has answered a question about of mine. Where we left off was he talked about his Scottish Rite, and then I asked him about people coming through the Blue Lodge just to go to the higher degrees, and he handled that phenomenally well. Take it away, Greg.
Well, I wanted to add one thing. One thing that's regrettable about the Scottish Rite experience is that many valleys are only conferring the obligatory degrees, you know, the mandatory degrees.
Like
and,
the mandatory
five or six.
I know my valley does that. That's
The 4th, the 14th, the 18th, the 30th, and 32nd degrees. And that is not enough for a man to make the necessary associations that he has to make to understand the themes that prevail in the four bodies of the Scottish Rite. And so if a valley is only conferring the mandatory degrees, they've got to have a remarkably good education program going along with that, or the man will never understand how the Scottish Rite can benefit him. And so I think this tension that exists between craft masonry and the Scottish Rite is far more prominent in those jurisdictions where the Scottish Rite is really not conferring much of what they have to confer.
That's actually a very interesting point. I know Dean, I don't know if Dean indicated this, but Dean and I had talked a great deal back and forth about the southern jurisdiction and northern jurisdiction, and then even how Nova Scotia plays into that, not even understanding the concept of southern jurisdiction and the ideas behind it, although they're similar, obviously, but just, you know, what goes on down south versus the different areas. And this idea of the conferral of the degrees and how it all takes place and what goes into it. And it's interesting that you mentioned that education program. As a member here in Southern California, in this Orient, I would have to say I have not seen much of that.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a push to education behind it. Now I misspoke in the sense that we do more than the 5 degrees. I think we do eight or nine. I can't remember last count. I know I'm in the 27th, and that's the one I worry about.
Mm-hmm.
But having gone through it and gone through the ceremonies, I remember it being sort of this rush. You know, a couple of weekends, let's go through it all, and then we go to these meetings, and there wasn't a lot going on with that. But which was similar to Blue Lodge. You know, there wasn't a lot of a difference in that, which again just might be unique to the sittings. And then I'm sure it does vary location to location, which actually brings me to the question that I had in the College of the Consistory. And I would love to hear more about that. I know I'm a part of it, and so I'm obviously have a vested interest. But of those that are listening, who may be interested in hearing about it, and who those who listen down the road, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the College of the Consistory is one of several programs that have been organized to facilitate an individual self-study program through the degrees. And I organized the College of the Consistory, I believe, in 2002. And basically to provide a syllabus and a program where men could learn about the degrees on their own time, from their own home, using some resources that's recommended to them for their own libraries. And so how the College of the Consistory works is that you enroll with an application that you can submit electronically by going to the Guthrie Scottish Rite website, and that's just guthrieScottishRite.org. And there's no cost to the program. And when you enroll in the program, I send you a multiple choice exam of the degrees of the Lodge of Perfection using Rex Hutchins' lectures to the degrees, Bridge to Light, as your resource guide. It's an open book test. You complete the exam, you return it to us. It's graded. We return the exam to you because it's yours. And with that, we send you a synopsis of the fourth degree and a series of essay questions that the fourth degree is intended to address. And we ask you to write an essay on any one of the questions that's given to you. And we like for the essays to be 1,000, 1,500 words or something like that. And you send those essays in. I forward those to the members of the Board of Adepts of the college, and then send it back to you. And I don't actually send the essay back to you, but I send then the fifth degree program to you as soon as the Board of Adepts have said it's fine, and there's usually around a two-week turnaround. And so the objective is that when you get through the 14th degree, then you automatically become an adept of the Lodge of Perfection. You go on the Board of Adepts yourself, and then you receive all of the essays that are being written by college members, and you can review those. And then another nice thing about the program is that we put the best essays online in an encrypted area of the website, so that everybody who's a college member has an entire resource file of various interpretations that men have had of the various teachings of the degrees. And we have about 780 members in the College of the Consistory from, I believe, 42 states and 9 foreign countries. And out of those 780-some-odd members, I believe 470 of them are actively participating in the program. So it has a significant participation rate, and I know that the fellows that have been doing this for quite some time now are just getting an awful lot of it out of it themselves. So that's what it's about.
Because insight, I have to say, just in my own having to do it, the aspect of having to write a 1,000-word paper every few months post college was daunting to say the least. But I, you know, even as a testimony to it, I'm impressed with it, just in the fact of the aspect of it making you think about these degrees and having to get into them.
You're right, Greg. It is daunting at first, but I don't think I've ever had anyone tell me that they didn't learn more by the effort they put into preparing their essays.
Yep. Yep.
You know, than if they had not done it. And so it's intended. I mean, the whole objective of the program is that when you're finished with the program, you should be able to teach masonry both in your lodge and in your Scottish Rite Valley. You should be the Masonic education guru, and that's one objective of the program, is to create scholarship.
That's fantastic. I'm very impressed, and even hearing the amount of people that have signed up for it and the number of consistently contributors. And it's important to say, I guess, too, the program itself, and this is from my memory, it's really spread over 5 years. It's
mm-hmm.
it's not a have them done in 365
That's
days
right.
and be done with
fact,
it.
We have a rule that it you can't spend you cannot complete it in less than 5 years. And as a matter of fact, we've been in, I guess this is we're starting our seventh year, I guess, and I believe that maybe the guys in the lead are now working on their 22nd degree.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow. So that's great. There are people that are really pulling it to the
mm-hmm.
pulling
And
far
it doesn't
ahead.
Make any difference. It's your work, your time, and your benefit,
yep.
so it's entirely up to you. And I just
kind
of facilitate it.
Hey, go ahead,
Greg. Hold on a second, Bob. I just want to ask Bob about the consistory. Is that specific to the southern jurisdiction, or does it matter which jurisdiction you're in? Or?
It doesn't matter. We ask everybody that enrolls in the program to acquire Rex Hutchins' book. Always would be good to acquire Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma. And we suggest too that they get a hold of Pike's 1871 magnum opus, which was his first attempt at the revision of the degrees of the Scottish Rite. And with those three books, you can motivate the program just fine. So those in the northern jurisdiction that might have a different degree structure, they might present different degrees. You're going to get enough information about the Pike degrees that you'll do fine.
Yeah, because I'm just getting a comment on there. There is some difference between the jurisdictions, obviously. My
yeah.
jurisdiction, the northern jurisdiction as well, and, you know, in comparison to the southern jurisdiction.
Yeah. That's very true. However, what we're dealing with here are the lessons. And so in the fourth degree, you know, where secrecy is one of the principal themes of that degree, well, secrecy means a lot of different things. And there's a vast latitude in how you can approach the topic of secrecy. So it doesn't really matter whether you've seen the northern jurisdiction or the Canadian or the southern jurisdiction or some other Supreme Council's version of the fourth degree. We're talking about secrecy as a virtue. And so you can look at any other resources that you want to try to interpret for yourself, why are we a secret organization and why is secrecy important? What does a Masonic confidence mean? You know, why is it important and that sort of thing? So, again, it's more common sense than it is structure, I think.
It's a,
to me,
just
it sounds
from
like a lot of podcast potential.
But it would all have to be tiled, and we'd all have to do it on the password here. Because even as I'm going through them and building on these ideas, as I start to talk to people about them, I have to ask them, okay, are you Scottish Rite Mason? You know, before we start, let's not delve too deep into the degree. Not for any particular reason of secrecy, but one thing that I'm discovering about it is just that it's difficult to really articulate what a seventh, eighth, or ninth degree is talking about without having that background of the fourth, fifth, or sixth leading up to it.
That's true. You
can talk about it and look at it, and even now I've been harping on all of my different electronic media how I'm trying to wade through the seventh degree, which I'm trying to pare down from 2,000 words, and just thinking it's like I could have come up with the ideas for it, but
well, I think
it definitely pulls from
it.
The proceedings.
It's one reason why we provide a synopsis of each of the degrees. So even if you're not, you haven't seen the degree, you know, you're getting a summary of what the degree is, and certainly what its principal themes are. So hopefully that's enough of a guide to get one started.
Yep.
And then we're
Absolutely. Not
the only. I mean, the Supreme Council in the Southern Jurisdiction has the Master Craftsman Program. A series of multiple choice exams, which has been very well received, and that's also an exciting education program that students of masonry should take advantage of.
I have to say, of all that I've found, this one seems to be the most robust. So
well,
for those who are out there want to dig into it, this is the one for you. not to interrupt you, Dean. I know we're getting close to the top here, and I wanted to.
I also
to
had
on
someone
a,
that wanted on the show to ask a question as well. So
okay, that's fine. Let me get to this one last aspect of things to talk about here, and then we can definitely get into that. I just wanted to talk a little bit about your book, Understanding Manhood. Earlier on, I wanted to touch on it and talk a little bit about it as we were specifically talking about your having grown up in a town. And this experience of entering manhood, as you said at the lodge room door, but I'd definitely like to talk a little bit about this book. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's called Understanding Manhood in America, and the subtitle is Freemasonry's Enduring Path to the Mature Masculine. And it was a book that I guess I was inspired by. My observation that men seem to really struggle with definitions of manhood. And there's so many paradigms out there that makes it kind of unclear what the male gender is all about and what we're supposed to be doing and why it needs to be raised up, so to speak. And so I wanted to investigate how American males have looked at the ideals of manhood and masculinity since the colonial period, and how the fraternal movement has moved in and out of the center of guiding and defining those ideals over that same period of time. And then I wanted to look at those issues that tend to cloud men's understanding about manhood, such as the media bashing and political correctness and the feminist movement and all of those kinds of things. And what I was looking for was really what is this path to manhood's all about? And I was impressed by Freemasonry's model for manhood because, again, in every generation of men prior to the 1930s, we clearly had three generations of men in lodge all the time. We had three generations of men in most of our homes all the time. So the icons of masculinity were passed down from the elder generation to the generation below, and then to that generation. And as long as sons were following their fathers into the fraternity, it sort of, that dynamic sort of worked. And then when all the out-migration occurred and the Depression and everything happened and everybody went off to war and came back in entirely different lifestyles, we have not really... we've not really discovered that there has always been an organization that has been purely about the interests of men in our society, and that organization has been Freemasonry. And so the emphasis of the book was just trying to get a real clear understanding of what the ideals of manhood are and what we have to do to lead a productive, fulfilled life where we serve the role of our gender the way it was genetically designed to happen. And I can tell you that the I did it primarily as just a self-study for myself, and I've discovered that it has resonated very well, especially with younger males. And a lot of young men have sent me emails and thanked me for the book. And it's so maybe it's something that, and I believe another thing is that men are starting to understand that Freemasonry is about the journey to manhood. It is it's the quest that we're on, and we project all the hero archetypes in making that quest, and what we make of it has everything to do with how consciously we are aware of the quest that we're on. So that's what that book's about.
Very nice. In writing it and having a chance to reflect and be in the material culture a bit and to hear what others have said about it, have you found a lot of the a lot of your ideas in it to in fact be the case? You mentioned that people resonated with it, but just in even case studying it, did you notice or have you found that it really is applicable? Are people applying it to their day to day?
No, I don't have any way of knowing that, but I will say this, that in the conversations that we're having in our education programs, in our lodges, and in the Scottish Rite, we're spending more and more time talking about how the lessons of the degrees relates to, you know, us as men. And how we make the transition from the lessons to the way we practice our lives. And so there's a lot of consciousness building going on, I think, among groups of guys that are sitting around that are discussing the journey of manhood as a part of the Masonic experience. So from that point of view, I'm feeling pretty good that it's having an impact.
That's great. For anybody out there who's interested, we do have it listed up off our website to find it and take a look at it. And it would be interesting to hear the results of it, of actually putting it into practice and using it in a context of the ritual and how it's affected them. I would be interested to hear that. If anybody has that experience out there, let us know. Dean, you had somebody who had a question that wanted to...
I did. I don't know how relevant it is now in the whole the way the show is taken. You kind of stumbled me over, but let me pull him on and see if he still wanted to ask a couple questions. Vitruvius, are you around?
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
All right.
You had a couple questions for Bob.
Yeah. Well, actually, since it's so late in the show, it wasn't just one question. It was two, of course. So I'll just throw these out, and whatever part or parts you want to respond to, feel free. But you are obviously very enthusiastic about the Scottish Rite, and I was just curious, based on the comment of another one of the guests, about whether there are any particular differences between the northern jurisdiction and the southern jurisdiction that would be interesting for those who aren't as familiar with the Scottish Rite to know about. Also, to just muddy the waters further, I'm curious about just your attitude towards newer Freemasons who might be interested in both and or the Scottish Rite and the York Rite. Mm-hmm. Any differences or similarities or whatever?
Sure. Well, I can't speak for the Northern Jurisdiction Scottish Rite except for what little I've read and hearsay. I believe that there is perhaps a fundamental policy difference between the two, and I think the southern jurisdiction is paying a lot of attention to the philosophy of Masonry and building the Scottish Rite as being the college course in Masonic teaching. it's my understanding, and the Northern Jurisdiction guys can certainly correct me if I'm wrong here, but my perception is that from a policy point of view, the Northern Jurisdiction has suggested that Masonic charities might be the best way for the Scottish Rite to build its image through its work with the childhood language disorders program and the literacy programs and stuff like that. And so they're trying to create more of a public image through their good works as a means of attracting men to their purpose. And the Southern Jurisdiction, I think, is more focused on just attracting men who want more light in masonry as a thing in and of itself. I do know that it's very difficult to revise the degrees in the Southern Jurisdiction, and I understand it's really fairly easy to do that in the Northern Jurisdiction, so that the degrees might be sort of an ever-evolving dynamic thing in the Northern Jurisdiction, whereas they're still pretty well fixed on the structure that Albert Pike gave it when he was Sovereign Grand Commander in the late 1800s. That's my perception of it. So I don't know if that's...
And just for the Canadian content here, me being a Canadian, there is a jurisdiction in Canada as well that you got to leave a note of this whole conversation, but I'll leave that aside for tonight due to the hour.
I think in part of a, I think what Vitruvius's question was also is I don't know, did he touch on the York Rite and Scottish Rite also, or was it just
no?
On jurisdiction?
Yeah, he did ask a question about that. I'm very active in the York Rite as well. I guess I should provide a warning that it's not quite as inclusive from the point of view that if you pursue all of the degrees and orders of the York Rite, I think you have to profess that your faith is that you belong to the Christian faith. But setting that caveat aside, the chapter and council degrees of the York Rite have allegorical and symbolic substance that's very profound, very instructive, and certainly adds to the completion of the Hieromic legend and up through the Second Temple legend, you know, that we start in the Craft Lodge degrees. Certainly one of the most important traditions of masonry, the Royal Arch tradition, is found in both the Scottish Rite and the York Rite. It's it's developed broader, I guess, in the York Rite than it is in the Scottish Rite. But it's if you're looking at Freemasonry as being a set of allegories that deserve interpretation, there's wonderful gems to be discovered in the Chapter Council degrees of the York Rite, and I would put them up against the Scottish Rite degrees in that regard. And that's why I think that that all Masons should probably at least be Royal Archmasons and Selected Royal Masters.
Thanks very much for your answer. That was very insightful.
Any other questions out there, Dean? I know we're past our hour here.
No, I think we're well on the way. Bob, if you had any last words, we are going to close out the recorded portion of the show in the next few minutes, and then we usually have our after show off the record chat, which you're more than welcome to join us in. And we encourage our listeners to come on live and listen to there, because we tend to get more lively questions and answers.
Well, just in closing, I want to thank you, Greg and Dean, for giving me the opportunity to participate in the interview, and hope that it provided some insights to those that were participating online. I will say that we need to pay a lot of attention to the younger Masons that are entering the fraternity today. This is the first group of males that have been joiners since before World War II, and they know a lot about masonry. They have a lot of expectations, we need to start thinking seriously about creating a culture that meets their needs rather than requiring them to become a part of the older generation's needs. Freemasonry is always about moving to the next lower generation, so, and adapting itself so that it accommodates the newest generation coming into it.
That's a great ending point. It will make another great new show, I believe. Greg, hold on a second here. I'm going to, Greg's having some technical issues here, so what I'm going to do is, I guess, start closing up the show a little bit. We do have next week, we have a few guests coming up, Brent Morris is coming up next week, and here I go. Greg, hold on a second here, guys. We are having some serious technical issues tonight, and my right-hand man, Greg, is not around. So what I'm going to do then is just tell everyone that to tune in next week for our show with Brent Morris. It has been great. For the first time, we're going to close this show, and all the hosts that can talk will be in sync, 100% sync on the closing note of this show, and it's going to be fantastic. I'm being instructed to hold on, and Greg's going to try to come on so he can say a few things before you leave, Bob.
Okay.
This is great. This is what makes this show so interesting. It's like a live show, and people will be listening to this weeks from now and getting still the great vibe here. Bob. While we're stretching the show out a little bit, is there anything happening in your area of masonry in the next couple months that someone might want to come down your way just to check out?
Well, all of the York Rite festivals and the Scottish Rite festivals have already concluded for the year. We have our annual communication of our Grand Lodge, and that's really all that we have on our calendars before next year. So, nope, no reason to come to Oklahoma.
What? I haven't been to Oklahoma yet. Does anyone else have any other big things happening in their jurisdiction that they want to mention? That they want to mention while we're on and get a little bit of free air time. Hold on a second. Nick has something to say. Of course, he's not linked in. Hold on. Let's unmute a few people here, see if we can get some discussion going on here. Greg,
I would
there?
Say I would invite anyone to email me. They can email me through the website or at gsrite@sbcglobal.net. If they would like to ask specific questions or continue dialogue, I'd be happy to try to communicate with them.
I think you tonight you raised some excellent points, and Greg, you should be able to talk right about now, but you raised some good points on how to grow the lodge and take some positive steps, you know, making a plan to get an active lodge and then go out and, you know, and the men actually should pretty much find them, hear about it, and come to you type of a thing instead of the other way around. But and I wish that we had more leadership of people that would assist us in coaching our lodges to that level. I don't think there's one solution. I think that with anything, different lodges will take different flavors and tangents and grow in different ways and find value for the members in their area in those areas. So I don't want everyone to take the same cookie cutter approach, but definitely I think that we're getting some very good discussion in these podcasts. Greg, I'm gonna close the show, buddy, because you are having some serious issues here, and you're not getting back to me. So with that,